There's a lot of things that I've said over the years which were perceived to be crazy. And then suddenly, they start to move mainstream.
I'm waiting for someone to convince me that we don't live in a simulation.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, taste, and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain. What if all you ever knew was a lie?
Hello and welcome to this iconic special on this 22nd anniversary of the most blatant inside job known as 9/11, in which some 3,000 people died on September the 11th, 2001, in an attack that was so obviously orchestrated from within the United States. And the world was changed forever, just as it was meant to be. It was the trigger that led to the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq, and death and destruction and mayhem across the Middle East. And it triggered also the Patriot Act, which was the first in that post 9/11 world we're still living in which basic freedoms are systematically deleted. And all of this came from a simple fact. The wrong people were blamed for 9/11. Oh, we want to invade Afghanistan. So what can we do? Well, what we'll say is Osama bin Laden was behind the attacks, then we can invade Afghanistan because he was behind the attacks and they're protecting him. And it's a technique that I've been calling since the 1990s, problem, reaction, solution. You create the problem, covertly blame someone else for it. You tell the public the version of the problem that you want them to believe, and you want them to react with anger, with fear, with enormous frustration, and say, what are you, what are they, authority, going to do about it? At which point those who've covertly created the problem got that public reaction, do something, then offer the solutions to the problems they have themselves covertly created. And September 11th and those attacks, when you look at the evidence, was a most obvious problem, reaction, solution, and we've seen so many since. With COVID, with human-caused climate change, because there's another version of problem, reaction, solution, which I call no problem, reaction, solution, when you don't even need a real problem, you need the public perception that there is a problem, and thus you can convince them you must provide the solution, which are changes in society that push on this dystopia month after month after month. Now, I was immediately dismissing the official narrative of 9/11. It made absolutely no sense. And throughout 2001 and into 2002, I researched a book, which I think, from my knowledge anyway, was the first major book to be published on the subject of challenging the official narrative. And it's called Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster: Why the Official Story of 9/11 is a Monumental Lie. And many, many years later, around 2018, I thought, I'm going to do an update of this book and bring in all the information that's and evidence that's come to light since. Well, it took me about 2 weeks to realize that actually updating that book was not on. It had to be a totally new book. And so in 2019, I published The Trigger About 9/11. And I read everything that moved. I researched everything it was possible to research. And it's a massive volume, the first half of which takes apart every aspect of the official story of 9/11. And in the second part, it names many of the people and organizations that were behind those attacks, and it wasn't 19 Arab hijackers. Now, I'm going to be talking to a very experienced airline pilot in America who very quickly realized there's no way that the official story of how the planes were flown and who by could possibly be true. But first, I just want to deal with the buildings falling, because they were the most obvious controlled demolition you could ever see. And before I get into the buildings themselves, let's remind ourselves of what a controlled demolition looks like. So there you have it, a controlled demolition where they put the charges in the particular parts of the building to make it fall on its own footprint. And of course, dust is everywhere. And here's another two to make the same point. And so we come to Building 7 in the World Trade Center. And even today, lots of people will say, what do you mean Building 7? It was the North Tower and the South Tower. Oh, yes, it was. They're the towers the planes hit. But there was another substantial building, skyscraper, that came down that day, later in the afternoon, that had not been hit by a plane. And yet it fell in its own footprint, exactly like a controlled demolition, which of course is what it was. And here is some footage of that. And it's sobering to think that the official story is that this massive building was brought down exactly as a controlled demolition, but by fire.
This is World Trade Center 7 just before it collapsed on September the 11th, 2001. It had not been hit by an aircraft. It had been damaged by falling debris and fire. But by 5:20 p.m., most of the fires had been extinguished. Although the building was 47 stories high, it doesn't fall sideways, nor collapse unevenly. For this to have happened, all of the building's vertical supports must have given way at almost exactly the same time. Yet the Federal Emergency Management Agency reported that the collapse was due primarily to fire. But what does it look like to you?
Yes, that building was brought down by fire, apparently, which means that the fire must have been so evenly spread and breaking the laws of physics in terms of its temperature, that all the major parts of the building failed at exactly the same time, so it came down on its own footprint. I mean, it's almost incomprehensible that the authorities would seek to explain it away with such absolute bloody nonsense. So, seen the controlled demolition buildings come down on the land that they're standing on, and we've also seen and heard the rat-a-tat-tat of the explosives going off before and during the collapse of the building. So let's go back to Building 7 here and watch for the very clear black explosions going off all over the building before and during its collapse. It's a controlled demolition. But of course, the authorities, the government, can't admit that, because if it did, the whole narrative, all of it, of 9/11 would fall apart. So what do they do? Well, what do governments do? They bloody lie. And so we've had a government agency produce a report telling us that somehow building, wasn't it by a plane? They say all debris came from the other two buildings or whatever. But that building fell in perfect controlled demolition style because of a fire.
No tall building had ever collapsed primarily due to fire. But that's exactly what investigators believe happened to the 47-story World Trade Center Building 7 on September 11th. According to a 3-year comprehensive building and fire safety investigation just completed by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST.
World Trade Center 7 collapsed because of fires. We really have a new kind of progressive collapse that we have discovered here, which is a fire-induced progressive collapse. And in fact, we've shown for the first time that fire can induce a progressive collapse.
NIST used detailed data describing the building and its contents to create the most complex computer simulation of a structure collapse ever made.
What absolute nonsense. And if you want to see an absolute catalog of nonsense, then read the 9/11 Commission report, which is a pack of lies from start to finish, to hide what really happened. And so we come to the main World Trade Center buildings, the North Tower and the South Tower. And here are a number of witnesses, and there were so many more, who are describing hearing and seeing explosions in the buildings before and during the collapse.
A huge explosion now raining debris on all of us.
It sounded like gunfire. You know, bang, 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 bang. And then all of a sudden, three big explosions.
About 50 consecutive bangs, and it went fell down like a waterfall.
And we heard the noise associated with an implosion.
We heard a very loud blast, an explosion. We looked up, and the building literally began to collapse before us.
We heard a loud explosion, and at that point, Building 2 was collapsing.
At that point, we heard a large boom. I looked up and just saw the building coming at us.
Do you know if it was an explosion or if it was a building collapse?
To me, it sounded like an explosion.
There was another major explosion. The building itself, literally the top of it, came down.
All of a sudden, you hear explosion, and you could see the building starting to collapse.
Huge explosion that we all heard and felt.
We understand now there has been a secondary explosion on Tower 2.
According to the Associated Press, another building that has either been attacked or exploded.
The tower, rather, that has collapsed, though, we are told, collapsed because of a third explosion.
And about an hour later after that, there was a huge explosion at the base of the South Tower. That's the One World Trade Center, and part of the building collapsed.
We could hear a rumble, which was about 5 seconds long, preceding the actual collapse, and then a boom when each of those towers collapsed.
Just seconds ago, there was a huge explosion, and it appears right now the Second World Trade Tower has just collapsed.
I was about five blocks away when I heard explosions.
And then you heard from far away, boom, boom.
And you heard the boom, 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 boom.
Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like as if they had detonated.
Detonated.
As if they were planning to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
From the corner, boom, 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 boom. Just like 20 straight hits. And as the bombs were going, people just started running. And I sat there and watched a few of them explode. And it just started going pop. It just started going boom, 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 boom. And he goes, how fast? I go, like firecrackers.
It staggers me how the authorities can have such contempt for the intelligence of the population that they can lie so obviously about the whole range of what happened on September the 11th. Not one facet of it stands up to scrutiny. But maybe it's not so staggering when you think how many people to this day still believe, journalists not least, God help us, still believe that 19 Arab hijackers were responsible for what happened that day, when the evidence that it was an inside job is absolutely overwhelming. And when you seek the truth about what happened, you're called a truther, which is not a term of endearment, it's a term of contempt. Oh, you're a truther, are you? Yeah, because I want to know why 3,000 people died on 9/11 and how the world was changed as a result. I want to know what happened. What do you mean? You don't believe the government? Oh my God! Governments lie through reflex action. That's what they do. And there's never perhaps been a more obvious example than September the 11th, 2001. Fortunately, there are intelligent people, and not only intelligent people, but intelligent people with a backbone, who have been prepared to not only see through the lies, but to press for justice and for the public to know what really happened. And so we have a series of organizations that have emerged since that day. Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There are thousands of them now worldwide, who are focusing on the building collapses because, as architects and engineers who design and build these bloody things, they know that the official story of how they fell is ridiculous, impossible. There's firefighters for 9/11 Truth. scientists for 9/11 truth, justice for 9/11 heroes, military officers for 9/11 truth, scholars for 9/11 truth and justice, lawyers for 9/11 inquiry. And then there's the pilot groups of pilots who can see that the story of how the planes were flown and who flew them is utterly insane. It's just not possible for what they are alleged to have done for them to have actually done. And despite all these organizations made up of experts in their field, the mainstream media, morons, hacks for the establishment, just go on repeating the official lies without question. Now, two of these pilot organizations are Pilots for 9/11 Truth and 9/11 Pilot Whistleblowers at 9/11pilots.org, which brings me to the director of that latter organization, a highly experienced pilot called Captain Dan Hanley. And I'll give you some bio before we talk to Dan. He says that he commenced flying more than 50 years ago in 1968, first as a civilian pilot, then as a naval aviator, and finally as a United Airlines captain. He has a career span of 35 years. He flew 15 different types of aircraft, accumulating more than 20,000 flight hours. And he says that with all my experience, I can unequivocally state that I could not possibly, he, with all that experience, could not possibly have flown the 9/11 flight profiles. In particular, the Pentagon profile, at those speeds and altitudes, and flying the spectacular aerial maneuvers performed by the alleged hijackers. In other words, the pilots that were supposed to fly the planes on 9/11 could not possibly have done so. So I'm delighted now to welcome from the United States, Captain Dan Hanley. Dan, thanks for joining us. With all your experience as a pilot over such a long period of time, and you were at Newark, New Jersey when it was all kicking off,
yes.
At what point did you think this doesn't make sense?
Well, I slept through the whole thing that morning, and when I got up and realized what had happened, I thought we were under attack like everybody else did. And even when I got back on the line with the security precautions they were taking, which really wasn't that much, which also got me into trouble when I reported it, but I still believe the official story until I start recognizing holes in the aviation security system. And I said, wait a minute, that can't be possible, that if they're that interested in security to allow all these holes to exist. And that's when I started reporting it, but it really wasn't until they announced the experience level of the hijackers, because I had flown Cessna aircraft way back 55 years ago.
Right.
And I also flew the 757, 767. And I knew, given that most of the training occurred in light Cessna aircraft, that there's no way in hell they could have controlled those aircraft. So I guess that's really when that happened. And I can't, because it's been so long ago, I can't remember the exact time frame that occurred. But that's when I start disbelieving the official story.
I mean, what sort of alerted you to the security breaches then? Because on the face of it, if the official story is true, which of course it isn't, it should never have been possible to do that with the security in place at the time, should it?
No, it shouldn't. But what they did, David, was they made all kind of promises. They said they were going to put cameras in the back of the aircraft, secondary barrier protection for the cockpit, have federal air marshals. It took 2 years before I was flying mainly New York, London. It took me 2 years before I saw my first federal air marshal. And there's so few of them. I knew that whole program was a farce. So they were only screening about 10% of the luggage going into the belly of the aircraft. So all these things were telling me, wait a minute, what are they talking about? The system's secure, get on an airplane, go to Disney World. Everything's fine. When I knew if it had occurred the way they were telling us it did, it wasn't possible with the security system they had set up.
So the piloting of the planes, I mean, it was just incredibly accurate, to say the least. And if we could pick up, first of all, I think the most blatant one of all, which is Flight 77, which is supposed to have hit the Pentagon. And there was this fantastic, so the official story tells us, low circle where the plane went round and came back into the Pentagon and hit the place where they'd been reinforcing it in case of a terrorist attack, exactly that point. And it was supposed to have been piloted by Hani Hanjour. And let me get this absolutely right. Instructors at the freeway airport in Bowie, Maryland, banned Hanjour from renting a one-engine plane just weeks before 9/11 because he was so incompetent and so bloody useless. He was known as a trainee noted for incompetence, according to the New York Times, which then still buys the official story. So tell me about Flight 77, what you think about that.
Well, I think it was an impossible maneuver for someone of his experience level, not only his experience level, but that exact maneuver you described, the 330-degree descending accelerating corkscrew turn isn't the challenge as much as getting it down a few feet off the surface at over 500 knots to precisely hit the Office of Naval Intelligence on its first attempt. Now, this maneuver was replicated in a simulator by another group, pilot group, and flown by highly experienced pilots. And they crashed the airplane trying to do this. And yet we've been led to believe Hani Hanjour did it on his first attempt. Now, you talked about going to the freeway airport in Maryland the month prior to 9/11. I actually talked to a gent named Marcel Bernard, who's a chief instructor. He was the chief instructor at the freeway airport, and he confirmed this story for me. And he told me that two of his instructors, Jerry Baxter and Ben Connor, actually went up on three flights between the two of them and both came back and said the same thing, don't rent him an airplane. But what did Hanjour do? He goes down the road to Congressional Air Charter, another airplane rental facility, and goes flying on a trip with an instructor named Eddie Shalev. And Eddie Shalev came back and told investigators he's a good pilot. And what appeared in the 9/11 Commission final report? Only Eddie Shalev's story, and it was an end note in the final report. And they didn't even interview Baxter or Connor. As a matter of fact, Connor said, I was expecting a call from the 9/11 Commission and never came. Now this information, and we've got it on our website, I can talk about later. There's an article that talks about how the FBI and the 9/11 Commission actually suppressed this key evidence. And imagine, had that been in the final report, would have had an entirely different outcome. So it was a total squash job by those two agencies of the government.
Well, the 9/11 Commission report was probably the biggest work of fiction in human history, wasn't it? I mean, right across the spectrum of the events of 9/11, there wasn't any truth told at all. It was all cover up. And so what about the planes that hit the Twin Towers? How difficult was it of being to achieve that?
Well, I wasn't a fighter pilot in the Navy. I flew another aircraft, but I've talked to guys that have with lots of experience. And they said, you just don't hop in an airplane and be able to target an aircraft that way, a high speed aircraft. And when you look at the closure rate at that speed of those aircraft, and the fact that the Twin Towers are only were only like 208 feet wide and the wingspan's 150 feet, and they hit them dead on, both of them. As a matter of fact, all three of these aircraft hit their targets dead on their first attempt, okay? And if the two planes that hit the towers was all that happened that day, if the Pentagon wasn't struck, they would have been limited to calling this a terrorist attack. But since a military facility was hit, the Pentagon, they called it an act of war and justified their illegal and unwarranted invasion into Afghanistan. So we equate the strike on the Twin Towers. Imagine you just driven your family car for a little over a year, and you hop into an 18-wheeler semi-tractor trailer you've never driven before, get it up to a very high speed, and try to drive it through a garage without scraping the sides of the truck. That's how accurate you would have had to have been. And we think that the reason so many people fell for the official story, number one, the government said it. Number two, the media supported what the government said. But most pilots, there's only a few hundred thousand pilots in the world. Most people aren't pilots, and they cannot conceive of the absurdity of this ludicrous notion that these pilots actually flew these aircraft that day.
So what's your view of what actually happened then? Because quite early on, I remember when I was researching this in 2001 and into 2002, controlled from the ground came up, and then more and more as the years unfolded.
Yes. Well, can I give a brief history of remote control?
Because so
many people say, come on, you can't control a large aircraft like that. But the history goes back to 1944, just towards the end of World War II, which is 79 years ago, where the U.S. Army Air Corps launched Operation Aphrodite. Actually, it was out of the U.K. And what they did was they gut out old B-24 bombers to lighten the weight of the aircraft and load it with 30,000 pounds of Torpex, which was a highly incendiary compound. And pilots were required to make the takeoff, but once they got airborne, they'd bail out, and these aircraft were remotely guided into targets in Europe. Now, this was 75, 79 years ago. And we point out on our website that I'll mention, JFK's older brother, Joe, was killed in one of these top secret missions when there was a malfunction and it blew up before he was able to bail out of the aircraft. Now, if you jump ahead, and there's several other examples in between, but if you jump ahead a full 40 years and imagine the technology advancements that occurred during that time frame with the advent of the computer age, in 1984, NASA and the FAA conducted a joint crash test experiment in a remote location. They used a four-engine commercial jet aircraft, a Boeing 720, and they loaded it up with crash dummies and cameras because they wanted to test crew and passenger survivability in the event of a crash landing. They took this big airplane off by remote control, flew it around the pattern several times before they intentionally crash landed the aircraft. Now, jump ahead to the early 90s. Actually, remote control aircraft research has been going on for decades. But if you jump ahead to the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, we say this system called the uninterruptible autopilot was developed and produced. And you can Google uninterruptible autopilot or Boeing Honeywell uninterruptible autopilot, and the first thing that pops up is a Wikipedia article that describes what I'm about to regarding this system. But it claims that Boeing didn't patent it until 2006. Well, this is true. We've got the patent on this thing, but we've also talked to witnesses who worked on this airplane in 1996, 5 years before 9/11. It was installed on a Boeing 757 aircraft. So the patent is there, but we know better that it was developed before 9/11. Now, this system enables electronic hijacking and remote control of a commercial jet aircraft in flight through employment of this system called the uninterruptible autopilot. And what it does is take complete control of the aircraft's autopilot and flight management computer and drives it to wherever it wants to take the target, whether to another airport to land it or into a building. And once the system's engaged, the pilots can no longer disconnect it. They're along for the ride. As a matter of fact, There's four ways of disengaging an autopilot. The switch you turned it on with, a button on the yoke or the steering wheel. You apply 70-pound grade or greater force on the one of the controls, or you pull the circuit breaker. Well, you can pull every circuit breaker in the airplane and the system's still engaged because it's got its own power source and it's backdoored. So it's a pretty incredible system, but it does exist.
Which begs the question, why, if they could do that, if the official narrative is true, why didn't they take over the planes and land them?
Precisely.
Of course, George, boy George Bush, came out at the time and said, well, we hope that at some point we'll be able to have a system which can take over the aircraft and land it. I mean, he passed for a pilot with the National Guard. He must have known, and people around him certainly knew, that that system already was in place. That was a diversion, wasn't it?
Exactly. That's exactly what it was. That was given. He made that statement in a speech between two 757s at O'Hare. And I used to have it on our website where he made that statement. But everybody knew about it. Like I say, I believe the whole thing was this huge black project. I've gone in with the Freedom of Information Act to the FAA and other government agencies saying, give us any information you have on the uninterruptible autopilot system. And there isn't any out there. As a matter of fact, I can go into it later, but what we've tried to do to get a hold of the government on all this stuff. But they've kept it well hidden. As a matter of fact, most pilots I've talked to aren't even aware that this system exists. When I point it out to them, they say, get out of here. And then when I go through and explain to them everything I just talked about, they're dumbfounded that it even exists on the airplane. So several years ago, and I can't find the article anymore, Lufthansa Airlines was taking delivery on new aircraft and they were doing a parts inventory to make sure they got everything they paid for. And they ran across this system and got a hold of Boeing and said, what is this? And when Boeing explained it to them, they said, get it out of the aircraft, which it cost them money to do, but they did get it out of the aircraft. So very secretive.
Yeah, one of the great ways they hide the truth from the public is they hide the level of potential of technology, don't they? I mean, they'll tell you when the technology comes into the public arena, oh, we've just developed this. They don't tell you that that's been possible to happen long before. We just haven't told you. And so when people like you come out and say, this is what they did, people go, oh, that's not possible.
Right, right. The 2006 patent to me was a distraction to make people look at it and say, oh, look what they've done to prevent another 9/11. They've come out with a system that can take control of it, because that's the public stated design purpose of the system, was to prevent would-be hijackers from commandeering a commercial jet aircraft in flight by remotely guiding it to one of 108 different airports in the world and auto-landing it. So people go, oh, well, they come up with a system to prevent another 9/11, and you say, not so fast. It was developed well before 9/11 and in place too. So
what in your view, Dan, happened to the passengers? Do you say they were on the planes that were involved, or they were landed and other planes took over?
Well, that's a big debate out there, David. Some people say, the plane didn't even take off, which is absurd. I was at Newark that morning at the airport. No United 93 took off with crew and passengers. But, you know, some people say, hey, there was an airborne swap of aircraft. And I don't know if you're familiar with Rebecca Ross' work, but she claimed they were diverted up to a New England airport. Passengers were required to make the phone calls before they were snuffed and the airplane taken someplace else. Another pilot named Phil McConnell claims that the airplanes were remotely guided out over the Atlantic and blown up there. And then there are others who claim the planes were diverted to Cleveland and Chicago. But that goes outside the scope of our 9/11 pilot whistleblowers, our organization. Because I don't know for sure and there's no way of proving it, I really don't know. But it's entirely possible. I'll point this out. United 175 that struck the South Tower, the second airplane did, the Twin Towers. There are four independent photographs taken by CNN and three other private photographers, and all four of them show a pod on the bottom of the aircraft. It's a long cylindrical pod. And I believe these photos were examined by photographic experts in Spain and determined that they were real. The pod was there. It wasn't Photoshop because the photographs were too grainy to have done anything like that. So if those pods were actually on the airplane, then it wasn't United 175 that hit the South Tower, because the bottom of the fuselage of a 767 is smooth. So some people claim that there was an airplane swap and that a military aircraft was replaced, while others even claim there were no airplanes. I'll be attacked when this is aired because I get attacked all the time, people saying there were no airplanes. I claim there were holograms. And then I'll say to them, well, if there were no airplanes, what happened to the four airplanes with crew and passengers on them? And they don't have an answer for that. So,
well, we all also have Operation Northwoods, don't we?
Right, exactly.
Which was a plan for people who haven't come across that at the time of President Kennedy to take over aircraft. Or replace aircraft, where they would take off from an East Coast airport, and then they would be replaced by one in the same colors, and which was a drone. They would fly it over Cuba. This is all in official documents, and they would explode it by radio signal over Cuba, and then blame the Cubans for Castro for blowing it up and justifying an invasion of Cuba. So, I mean, that's in official documents that they were preparing to do that in the 1960s.
Exactly. I followed Northwoods, and Kennedy obviously turned that down, thank God. But that's one of many false examples of false flags the United States has been involved in. I mean, you can go back to Gulf of Tonkin. You can talk about even as recent as the Oklahoma City bombing. There's any number of false flag events that the United States has been involved in. So none of this surprises me, this false flag that they did, but it was on such a grand scale. And I believe that something like the Oklahoma City bombing of the Murray building there was a test of the gullibility of the U.S. population as to what they believed. And I believe that the 9/11 false flag was a global test of the gullibility of the world's population into believing it. And it works so far. It's people like you, David, that are out here doing this, that's keeping the story alive. And that's what needs to be done.
So let's just take the planes took off. There was interaction between the pilots and air traffic control, which then suddenly stopped.
Right.
So the pilots would have been what? They'd have been looking at each other going, what's gone on, when the plane started doing things that had nothing to do with what they were doing.
Right. It had to have been horrifying for them. Now, that's the big question. Some people claim that this uninterruptible autopilot system silences radio communication and the aircraft transponder, but I can't find that in writing anywhere. But somehow the radios were shut off, as were their transponders. But imagine that scenario you just described, where the airplane just takes off on its own. They try to disconnect the autopilot and they can't do it. They try to get a radio call out and that doesn't happen. So it had to have been horrifying for them.
So what overall or where overall do you think we are now? I mean, this is the 22nd anniversary. There's been so much exposure of the lies, and still we're still here, and people that were blatantly involved in it are still at large. I mean, it must get very frustrating for you.
It does, but I still won't give up, and neither will you.
No way.
Let me just try to, I'm not going to get into our group. I'm the director and international spokesperson for a group called 9/11 Pilot Whistleblower.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to expose is exactly what we've been talking about here. And we spent 3 years going to the U.S. government saying, we want you to investigate this. And we did letter writing, emails, phone calls, et cetera, and were totally ignored. And just recently, I sent a letter to President Biden saying, hey, and I had sent two letters to him before knowing he hadn't read them, but hopefully somebody on his staff might, saying, hey, we gave the U.S. government a chance to investigate this. Now we're going to take it to other countries that would be more interested, and that is the Muslim, the 2 billion Muslim community that's been so harmed by 9/11 with Islamophobia still running rampant 22 years later here. So what we've done is joined hands with the biggest 9/11 truth groups and individuals in the world, and we've created this 9/11 Truth Coalition of the Willing. And what we're trying to do is recruit the ministers of foreign affairs from the 57 Islamic countries that are members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. And people that aren't familiar with that organization, it's the United Nations of the Islamic world. It represents these 57 countries, and they claim to be the collective voice of the Muslim community. So we petitioned them in letters and trying to get through to them on phone calls. I've only been successful once there, trying to say, hey, the United States, you'll agree with me on this statement, David, the United States government, or any Western government for that matter, will ever open an investigation into 9/11, regardless of who's in office, because I believe they're complicit in the crime. However, you look at how many nations, there's 193 countries in the world, and look at how few world leaders have spoken out. You can talk about Mahathir Mohammed in Malaysia, or Ahmadinejad in Iran, a few other people spoke out, but nobody else will, because I believe they're afraid they'll get whacked, the leader of the country, or they'll destroy the country financially or otherwise. So they looked at what's happened in Libya and in Iraq, and they don't want that to happen in their country. But we believe that if we could join together these 57 governments, they can't attack all of them at once, and get them on the same page and hold this, we call it an International Islamic Commission for 9/11 Inquiry, a Muslim 9/11 Commission. And we believe that if we could get that out to 2 billion Muslims, that's one quarter of the global population, that we might have some success in bringing this all to public light. I know it's a bold venture, and it's a long shot, but because I've been involved so long in this and realized that the U.S. government isn't going to do anything, I've been up in Washington kicking doors down, trying to get politicians to listen, and it's a hopeless endeavor. So I just looked at the real picture of what's going on and who might be interested, and this, to me, is our last hope of getting it out to the global population.
Well, yeah, obviously, we all know that an enormous number of politicians are just moronic. They just go along with anything. But there must be a lot of politicians who absolutely know the official story of 9/11 is not true, and they just do nothing.
Right. Well, that gets into who we think was responsible for the planning and execution of 9/11, and who. What organizations have a stranglehold on every level and branch of the U.S. government, Congress and the White House. So we both know who that is.
There are some who would like to speak out, but are terrified of the consequences and their funding to continue in politics, I'm sure. But also the pilots. I mean, you're an experienced pilot, but there's a lot of experienced pilots who must also know that exactly. The official narrative of the hijackers flying the planes when they couldn't fly Cessnas is ridiculous. But I guess it's fear that stops them.
Exactly. I mean, I'm a part of another organization called Whistleblowing Airline Pilots Association, and we're attacking that very thing. And you look at the measures an airline will go through to silence a would-be whistleblower. And part of what we did with our organization was go out and interview pilots to get their assessment of the pilot skills and whether or not they could fly those profiles. And it was like pulling teeth to get pilots. We got them on film, and we only have 10 of them on our website. We have more, but YouTube started taking them down saying it was hate speech. But
It's hate speech to say it's not possible to fly a plane if you can't fly a Cessna.
So we quit putting them on YouTube, but we can go to another video platform, but we didn't want to lose our channel. So we've got 10 of them on our website, and they're all echoing the same thing I've said, that it was impossible for them to have flown the airplane. But getting back to what you said, as near as I can determine, there's roughly 300,000 pilots in the world. Okay. And that sounds like a big number, but there's 8 billion people on the planet. So it really is a small fraction of the global population. And after 9/11, once I realized that they were using 9/11 for Afghanistan, shock and awe in Iraq, et cetera, I actually was running around United Airlines saying to pilots, we've got to do something, because at the same time, United was in bankruptcy and we were getting beat to death by a bankruptcy court in Chicago. And they said, no, we can't say anything. The patriotic fervor is too high. We'll get crucified. We can't go there, Dan. So they could have said something early on. There were people early on that realized that the story was a lie, but they didn't do it. And the tragedy is 22 years later, they're still not doing it. I mean, you can talk about the Airline Pilots Association, the largest pilot union in the world, represents 60,000 pilots on the North American continent alone. They don't condemn the official story. All they did was put up a monument for the ALPA pilots that were killed that day outside their headquarters. But they could have spoken out, and they haven't. So it's sad.
I want to come to your treatment before we finish. But I'm sure people have so many questions about 9/11, of course. And a couple of them, one about the Twin Towers and one about the Pentagon. What's your view of an airplane, which, you know, they're big and they're strong in the sense of doing the job they do, but in terms of, you know, solid steel, they're not that strong at all, are they, with the aluminium and all that that's involved, the very thin aluminium by comparison. What's your view of the claim that being hit by an aircraft could bring down those massive towers?
Well, the big argument there, some people say that the aircraft can't even achieve those speeds. Other aircraft structural engineers say, yes, they could. A big argument about whether or not they'll fall apart. But if you look at a 100-ton aircraft traveling at 500 knots, that's a lot of kinetic energy. And people say, that's why they argue, no, there were no airplanes, that there were pre-planted explosives in the building, which I don't agree with. And I believe that the aircraft traveling at the speed they did, given the weight of the aircraft, could have made the hole in the building. But I don't believe the jet fuel fires that ensued and the structural damage caused by the aircraft brought the buildings down. I believe it was a controlled demolition.
I couldn't agree more. And what about the Pentagon? Do you think there was a plane, or there was a missile? Or
again, people argue that point, and that's outside the scope of our organization's contention, because all we say is the hijackers couldn't have flown it, the uninterrupted autopilot could. But my own personal view, I've heard both sides of the story, and it's entirely possible that there was an aircraft swap, and whatever happened to American 77, I don't know. But I've also talked with David Chandler, who's a physics teacher who has his own organization, and he claims, based on flight data recorder and other information he had, that American 77 was there. I spent an hour and a half with him and one of his associates on Skype share screen, and they showed me all this data that they had, and it was very convincing. The only problem I have with it is that the government provided some of the data, and I don't trust anything
that's the
government
problem.
Puts out.
You can't believe a thing that comes out of government. Yeah. That's the trouble, sadly.
Right.
So you started speaking out, and about you didn't buy the story. And you were talking about airport security and United Airlines security. Suddenly, your life fell apart, didn't it? What exactly happened?
Well, initially, I was flying out of JFK in Newark, and I had flight attendants who had friends that were killed in United 93 that crashed out in Pennsylvania. And they were almost freaking out over the whole situation here and not being protected in the back by those promises that had been made by government. So they asked me to say something, which I did, just at my chief pilot and my union leaders, who were friends of mine in New York, I told them, and they said, "Watch it, Dan, these guys are nasty." So I said, "Who?" And they wouldn't tell me. But because I got that feedback from them, I decided to file a federal report called the Captain's Report. And I got blowback from the company saying, from a manager saying, "The company thinks you're a big mouth, loose cannon whistleblower and wants you to go away." And then I decided I was going to write a letter to the CEO of United, and my union leader in New York pleaded with me to let him run it by the lawyers in Chicago, which I did. I'll make the story short because it can last an hour. The long story short, the union lawyer said, "Don't send the letter in," even though he agreed with what I was stating. And basically what I was saying was, hey, the pressure is being exerted on the union because we're in bankruptcy. It's precluding them from representing pilots out on the line because federal reports are being stonewalled. So the union leader, the union lawyer said to me, "Dan, if you send that letter in, you'll never fly another United Airlines airplane again in your life." I said, "What are they going to do to me? I said, "They'll find a way to professionally, medically, or psychologically ground you for life. Trust me, we've seen it happen before." Well, I had too, David, and what I did to protect myself, I had a correspondence trail a mile long. I had witnesses, I had recorded phone conversations, and I sought mental health professionals in Atlanta, where I was living at the time, and said, "Hey, test me. They're going to try to say that I'm mentally unstable," which they did. So naive Dan believes I can press forward with this. So what I did was file a federal report that brought the FAA in. And as soon as I did that, I was removed from schedule without warning. They said, "You've got to come up to New York and talk to us about these reports." Well, they shouldn't have even had them, because when you file these reports, you guarantee anonymity and you can file them with impunity. And I said, "What are you doing with them?" They said, "No, you have to." I said, "Well, the union lawyers said they won't represent me. I got to bring my attorney," and they wouldn't let me do it. So we're at an impasse. So the next thing I know is they put me on sick list. And you only have so much sick list on the book. And I was running out of sick list. I was going to go non-pay. And I called my chief pilot and said, "Hey, Bob, how this is punitive. I haven't done anything wrong." And he said, "Dan, submit to the employee assistance program. It's guaranteed protection of your pay. The company endorses the FAA, the union all endorse the program. All you have to do is come to Chicago and see a doctor. And that'll be all you have to do, is agree to go along with what we say," which I did. I went up and saw the doctor. And one of the first questions he asked me was, "Have you been seeing a mental health professional?" I said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I have. Hold on." And I pulled out my cell phone and handed it to him. I go, "This is my doctor in Atlanta," and he talked to him, right? So I'm stretching this out too far, but I wound up going over and seeing the doctor, and was actually enticed into, I thought I was going over to an office. It was a mental health facility. It was a mental health hospital. And I talked to a Catholic nun that was a psychologist, but she wasn't a psychiatrist. And she goes, "Look," it was real late in the day, and I had a long day. And she goes, "Look, you've got to see a psychiatrist. The company wants you to. We can make arrangements for you to spend the night here." It was a big mistake on my part, but I was tired. She said, "You'll see a psychiatrist first thing in the morning." So I thought, okay, I'll do that rather than catch a cab out and back. And I did that. And it was a big mistake, because my one night, overnight there, wound up 3 days. Where I had to, it was one flew over the cuckoo's nest. I had to have meals with people, had to attend group therapy sessions, et cetera. And I finally met a psychiatrist on my third day there. I said, "I'm not going to play your game anymore. I'm going along with it," as I was required to do. I said, what is your diagnosis going to be? And she goes, well, we're going to say you were bipolar. Well, I smiled and I said, look, it's the first time I met you and I haven't exhibited any symptoms of bipolar disorder. I know what it is. And she goes, well, that's what we're going to say. And I said, well, I have mental health professionals in Atlanta that beg to differ with you on this diagnosis. So I got out of there. The skids were greased. They medically grounded me on that diagnosis. And I fought for 5 years to get my medical. Well, no, I didn't. I realized what I was up against with the government. And I fought for 5 years to expose this gross violation of RICO laws, of what they did to me. And they closed my case after 5 years without interviewing any of my witnesses or reviewing any of my evidence. So this group we have called Whistleblowing Airline Pilots Association, we're going to try to expose this because there's many pilots out there this has happened to. As a matter of fact, just recently, a Delta pilot named Carlene Pettit won her case after 5 years and spending $500,000 on the exact same thing. She had a PhD in safety and reporting safety issues at Delta Airlines. They pulled her off the line, sent her to the shrink, determined she was bipolar and grounded her. I mean, it's absurd what the lengths will go, and it's collusion between the airlines and the FAA that caused this to occur.
The airline FAA corruption is legendary, isn't it? I've read a heck of a lot about it. But so you start speaking out about 9/11, you start speaking out about airport security, and your own airline sets out to label you basically crazy or psychologically imbalanced. They couldn't care less about you and your family as long as they shut you up.
Well, it basically almost destroyed me. I'm happily married now, but it destroyed a 27-year marriage, alienated my two kids who blame me for the divorce, still believe the official story, think I'm a whacked out conspiracy nut. They don't talk to me to this day. I lost $4 million in pay, pension, and stock. It destroyed a 35-year career in aviation and ruined my reputation as a pilot. So I paid a heavy price for doing what I did. And had I been given the opportunity to do it over again, I would have, but I would have proceeded with more caution. I would have gotten an aviation attorney in advance. There's a lot of things I know now that I didn't know then. And you got to realize this was the 2002, 2003 timeframe. And we know a heck of a lot more about how corrupt the government is now than we did 20 years ago.
I think anyone that comes into this, like doctors that spoke out over the COVID situation, scientists that speak out about human-caused climate change and say it's the official narrative isn't true, they all find to their shock just what evil has been in their midst without them realizing it was all around them in terms of authority. I think the way you've stuck with it, Dan, against all the things that you've described, all the consequences, is absolutely fantastic. And if there was a lot more Dan Handlers in the world, it would be a different place. So I wish you all the best ongoing. Anything that I can do to help get information out, just ask. And I think it's incredible. I would hope embarrassing for people, whether they're pilots or whether they're people who know, who see what sacrifices you've made against their silence. And I hope they might be shamed into speaking out. But of course, they're so terrified of the consequences of doing so that they'll probably go to their grave knowing it's a lie but saying nothing.
That's what's dangerous about this, David, because what happened to me sends a chilling signal out to any other airline pilot that ever contemplated speaking out to keep your head down or you're going to lose it. So it's not just with regard to 9/11, it's any safety issue out there. Pilots are afraid to speak out because they know what will happen to them, and it's unsafe.
And it's it just made me chuckle just a little bit to think of people that say to me, they could never cover it up because people would speak out if they knew, you know. Well, now with your example, we see why they don't.
Exactly. And you look at this medical grounding using psychiatrists. This goes back to Joe Stalin's Reign of Terror. It was called I can't think of what the term is. It's mechanisms of dissent. What he did, anyone that opposed the government, he would throw them in an insane asylum, but he'd leave them there. So psychopathological mechanisms of dissent, that's what I was groping for. That's what it was called. And it's going on today. If you own a piece of paper that's required for you to conduct your business, whether you're a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, a pilot, a nurse, and you lose that certificate, you're not going to practice your profession anymore. And for pilots, you're required to have two pieces of paper. One is your license, and the other is your medical certificate. If you lose that medical certificate, it's as good as losing your license. So I paid, not just financially and otherwise, I paid a heavy price for it. So,
well, we're very grateful to you, Dan, because without people like you, we wouldn't know what we do. And so thanks for talking to us, and the very best with everything you do.
Well, thank you, David. It's a pleasure and a privilege to meet you. And thank you for having me on the program.
So there we go. Another year passes, the 22nd, since that most blatant of false flag inside jobs called 9/11. And thank goodness that people like Dan Hanley and others won't let it go and won't let it drop, because before our eyes, in plain sight, the so-called deep state of America, in league with other places, including Israel massively, let's forget that if you look at the evidence. 3,000 people were killed. The world was changed. And the horrors of 9/11 are still massively in the memory of people that experienced it, people that lost loved ones, obviously. And 22 years later, those people are still at large. And in the meantime, they've been continuing to make decisions that have dictated the direction of the world. 9/11 was when this global cult, as I call it, really put itself on public display. And we're going to let them get away with it by thinking, oh, that's past now. Not around here, we won't. I hope you've got something out of it. And for people that are new to 9/11, because 22, people of 22 years of age and a little bit older, they would not have any memory of it. That's how long it's been. But whether you were there at the time or whether you're learning about it now, this is a line in the sand. We must not let it go.
There's a lot of things that I've said over the years which were perceived to be crazy. And then suddenly, they start to move mainstream.
Waiting for someone to convince me that we don't live in a simulation.
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, taste, and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain.